Welcome back. It's a Tuesday, the 14th day of May, 2019. I'm your host, Mark Hall. And let's start off our look at what's going on around the nation and around the world today with a story or two from the Better Late Than Never files. Of course, I'm talking about Spygate, the attempted coup that seems to have failed. I guess we'll wait and see on that score. Attorney General William Barr has appointed U.S. Attorney John H. Durham of Connecticut to examine the origins of the bogus Russia, Russia, Russia investigation of now President Trump to determine if the FBI's spying on their campaign was, quote, lawful and appropriate. Who are we kidding? And this via Fox News. The move comes, it says, as the Trump administration has demanded answers over the use of informants. Another term is spies, but the left-wing press doesn't like that one at all in this context, on his 2016 campaign. And according to Fox, Barr is now serious about this and has assembled a team from the DOJ to participate in the probe, adding that Durham is known as a, quote, hard-charging bulldog prosecutor, according to their sources, who also say that the focus of the probe includes the pre-transition period prior to November 7th, election day of 2016, including the use and initiation of informants, as well as, of course, potential, and who are we kidding there either, Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act or Fourth Amendment violating Star Chamber court abuses. And come on, folks, if we didn't want abuses, we wouldn't have violated the Constitution with the Patriot Act to begin with. Durham, the story suggests, is a good choice because he's previously investigated law enforcement corruption as well as the destruction of CIA videotapes and, get this, relationships of the Boston FBI offices with mobsters, which seems to put him right in Robert Mueller's wheelhouse. Of note, in January, House Republicans Jim Jordan and Mark Meadows wrote to Durham saying that they had discovered he was investigating former FBI General Counselor James Baker over unauthorized leaks to the media, and they added, quote, "We know the DOJ and FBI departed from traditional investigative and prosecutorial practices and insufficiently adhered to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act," unquote. And how's that for some politically expedient understatement? According to the report, Durham's review would run in parallel with the ongoing, and kind of slow it would seem in hindsight, DOJ probe by Inspector General Michael Horowitz. And meanwhile, the Republicans have been seeking answers as well from, remember this guy? U.S. Attorney for Utah, John Huber, who was appointed by former AG Do-Nothing Jeff Sessions to review FBI and DOJ surveillance abuses, as well as authorities' handling of the probe into the Clinton Foundation corruption. And you probably don't need me to tell you that the stories also say not much has come of anything Huber seems to have been doing, at least so far, for sure. And as I say that, yes, I know, folks, we all do. The wheels of justice turn slowly, and if you really want to get convictions on high-level acts of treason, they do have to be done right. Unless, obviously, as we've seen for 2 years now, it's part of a larger coup. Meanwhile, there may be more news coming out in the short term, if not perps in orange jumpsuits. Speaking on Fox Sunday Morning Futures, Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Lindsey Graham said, quote, "There's a document that's classified that I'm going to try to get unclassified that takes the dossier," meaning the infamous Fusion GPS Steele dossier, "all the pages of it," he said, "and how it was supposedly verified," adding that there really is no verification other than media reports that were generated by reporters that received the dossier. And as you know, all kinds of information has come to light lately, including notes taken during a meeting 10 days before the deception of the FISA court and the issuing of the bogus warrants, where Deputy Assistant Secretary of State Kathleen Kavalak tried to blow the whistle on the Steele BS. Her notes from the meeting have now been revealed, and it now seems like the FBI not only knew what they were doing, but they tried to cover up the fact that they knew as well. Weighing in on this whole mess, former Deputy Assistant U.S. Attorney General in the Office of Legal Counsel, John Yoo, joined Laura Ingraham on the Ingraham Angle on Monday night and told her that the criminals involved here ought to be very worried. Quote, "If I were the Democrats, I would be quite worried. And the reason why is by appointing a U.S. attorney, Attorney General Barr is essentially saying that he thinks it's possible that criminal violations occurred in the start of the whole investigation into any kind of Trump-Russia collusion. And as Judge Starr pointed out, there's already an Inspector General investigation that's been going on that is going to come to a conclusion. And that's what you would do if you were just interested in reforming. But you wouldn't go with a U.S. attorney like Durham or someone of his stature unless the Attorney General thinks something criminal might have happened. And honestly, folks, I think the truth is, we'd have to admit, there's no denying that a whole lot of things criminal happened. The question is whether they've been able to destroy all the evidence and kill all the witnesses yet. In other words, can you prove it, even in what now passes for a deep state court of law? And I guess since we're talking about the possibility, at least, of corrupt courts, I might as well throw these couple of stories in that I was thinking about doing later. John Edmonds says a piece from GoldEagle.com, former VP at J.P. Morgan Chase Bank may be headed to prison for cheating clients and investors. Oh, well, what else is new, right? I guess that's new because there aren't many big banksters that actually end up in orange jumpsuits. But it says metal investors can hope it won't be before he's done helping federal investigators, sick, catch even bigger fish. Edmonds pled guilty to spoofing precious metals markets, quote, hundreds of times with the knowledge and consent of his immediate supervisors, unquote, last October. And the court delayed sentencing for those crimes again last week. And that, says the piece by Clint Senior here, is a very good sign, because the move to delay implies that Edmonds is still assisting the Department of Justice investigation of other banksters, both within J.P. Morgan and elsewhere. And it's the second time his sentencing has been postponed. Basically, all this has to do with illegal price manipulation and rigging of the crooked casinos, as your host likes to refer to it, the gold and silver markets, and manipulation by the bullion banks, as Senior, is no longer even a theory. It's a fact, because market watchers like Ted Butler and Gatta have been aggregating extensive evidence of price rigging for years. I've seen data like this, folks, going back a full two decades at this point. And despite all of that, though, precious metals investors and those who are looking for alternatives to other rigged markets should avoid counting any chickens before they hatch, because you may recall that the CFTC spent years allegedly looking for manipulation in the silver market, and yeah, a blind pig would probably have found a truffle in that interval. And that so-called investigation ended 4 years ago in 2015 without a single bankster being held to account. And the trouble is, the huge pile of evidence now available, does this sound familiar, reveals just how much CFTC officials had to overlook in order to be able to, well, do what we've gotten so used to in so many other areas, turn a blind eye to justice. Here's one more from the same source, written by Mark O'Byrne, courtesy of Reuters as well, about how seven banks have been caught rigging the multi-trillion dollar foreign exchange market. Much bigger than the gold and certainly silver markets, but with some obvious connections. Barclays, Citigroup, HSBC, J.P. Morgan, and three other banksters are said to be fined. No, nobody goes to jail there. By EU antitrust regulators in coming weeks for rigging the multi-trillion dollar foreign exchange market, said two people familiar with the matter. The other three lenders are the Royal Bank of Scotland, UBS, and a small Japanese bank, they said, which will see a 10% cut in their fines for having admitted to the wrongdoing. Now note, folks, no criminal charges here, and the so-called antitrust enforcer for the EU, which has been investigating the case for over 6 years and could hand out fines amounting to as much as 10% of a company's global turnover for breaching EU rules, declined to comment, as did most of the banksters. And get this, it's possible the EU might decide to space out their rulings against the banks over several weeks, rather than lumping them all together in one day and getting a whole lot more headlines, said sources. On the next to the continuing build-up towards World War III, although if you remember Follow the Money, we're still basically talking about the same thing. One day after a string of attacks on two Saudi oil tankers and two other vessels in the Strait of Hormuz, evidently intended to disrupt global oil flows and perhaps raise prices, if not escalate tensions towards the war, Yemen's Iran-backed Houthi rebels carried out multiple drone attacks on two Aramco pipeline booster stations, a strike that was also intended to disrupt world oil supplies, according to the Saudi energy minister Khalid Al-Fali, who told their captive news agency Al-Arabiya that the attacks targeted two pipeline booster stations between the eastern province and the city of Yanbu, and that no less than seven different drones were involved in the attacks on the installations. And right on schedule, we have this, courtesy of both Zero Hedge and originally the New York Times. A leaked Pentagon plan, they say, calls for 120,000 troops to eventually be shipped, well, where? To the latest war front, towards Iran. As Michael Pompeo, it begins, travels to Brussels to discuss the Iranian threat amid a flare-up in tensions that's brought the U.S. to the brink of an armed conflict. Yet again, the New York Times has published details from a confidential military plan presented to top national security officials that envisions sending as many as 120,000 troops to the Mideast should Iran attack American forces or start ramping up work on nuclear weapons, or maybe some other excuse will do. And your host will come back to that one in a minute, folks, because the New York Times didn't seem to mention it outright. And although the revised plan, it had been modified to incorporate suggestions from John Bolton, doesn't include plans yet for a land invasion, it does reflect the, quote, influence of Mr. Bolton, one of the administration's most virulent Iran hawks, whose push for confrontation with Tehran was ignored more than a decade ago by President George W. Bush. No, they say it's not clear yet, anyway, whether Trump has seen the plan himself or even been briefed on it. But asked about it, Trump said, quote, we'll see what happens with Iran. If they do anything, it would be a very bad mistake. All right, details say, yep, 120,000 troops. That would be close to the size of the force that invaded Iraq back in 2003. And certainly it's true deploying this many troops would take weeks or months, but the most likely trigger remains an attack by Iran's Revolutionary Guard, the IRGC, and their fleet of small boats has had a history of approaching U.S. Navy ships at high speed. And though the plan includes provisions for U.S. response if Iran once again starts to stockpile nuclear fuel, if they do so, America, it says, would have more than a year to formulate a coherent response. Don't worry, folks, they've been working on this for a lot longer than that. Because it would take at least that long for Iran to stockpile enough nuclear material to fashion a weapon. Cyber weapons, of course, could be used to paralyze the Iranian economy during the opening salvo of the conflict, says the New York Times, in hopes this would be enough to cripple Iran before any bombs were dropped. Such an operation would call for implants or beacons inside U.S. networks, although given Iran's sophisticated cyber weapons, and increasingly more so, such an attack, they say, would still pose significant risks. One of those, by the way, that I don't see the New York Times getting particularly concerned about is that it just might upset Russia a bit and encourage them to do something, well, World War III-ish, as if they didn't have plenty of provocation on that score already. And no, it notes, this is the first time since joining the Trump administration that Bolton has sought updated plans to invade Iran. Now, folks, I know one thing that's missing from this entire piece, besides the Russia wild card even, and that is the southern border invasion. Because I can tell you one thing for sure. If I was Iran, and given that this has been a long time coming, I would have used the opportunity presented by a completely open southern border and millions of people coming across basically unmolested to, install a whole bunch of sleeper cells, probably even get the Obama regime to buy bus tickets for them and distribute them all over the United States, so that if and when this situation arose, Iran could credibly tell President Trump and all the others in Washington, if you dare to do anything, we're going to unleash our sleeper cells, kill a whole bunch of people in gun-free killing zones, blow a whole lot of people up in Christian churches, and probably detonate a dirty bomb or two. As well as, of course, cripple the incredibly vulnerable U.S. power grid and energy infrastructure. Yeah, when it comes to a border invasion, there's a whole lot more that we're not being told than the obvious stuff that we're not being told. But you'd be a fool to be any foreign power and not taking advantage of it. And it really is that simple. We got other border invasion stories, too, mostly continuations of things we've been hearing, but it just keeps getting worse. This one from Breitbart says U.S. Border Patrol officials are now using air transportation to move migrants from overcrowded processing centers to lesser impacted facilities yet, particularly when it comes to the Rio Grande Valley, where they're flying migrants from McAllen, Texas, to other places in Texas, according to the WAPO. Related item says that about a third of the people that claim to be families, so far at least, have been revealed to be fraudsters. And I guess given that they're already willing to break the law to come in the first place, why not add a little lying on top of that? Gee. Especially since there's so much good money to be made by claiming that the kiddies are part of the family as opposed to sex slaves. Which may help explain at least in part why Hollywood is so hot to see the invasion continue. And we've got more news from cities on the receiving end of the migrant influx as well. The socialist, a.k.a. Democrat-run city of Albuquerque, New Mexico, is now forcing United States-born kids out of city accommodations in order to provide cheap temporary housing for more migrants. The first victim, says a Breitbart piece by Neil Monroe, were American children in the state 4-H Club who were expecting to use their taxpayer-funded but temporary accommodations at the Expo New Mexico Convention Center for a 4-day course on horse riding. Said Dr. Donnie McDougall to KRQE.com, "My daughter was in tears about this. We were extremely disappointed when we have a quality facility like Expo New Mexico and the rug gets ripped out from under our kids' feet." The parents, of course, will pick up the additional tab. That camp is now going to be forced to move to Las Cruces, quite a ways away. But the city said it was more important that various pro-migration organizations that help the asylum seekers save the money instead. KRQE, though, noted that the city and its officials have different priorities than their own citizenry. Quoting Mariela Ruiz Angel at the Office of Immigrant and Refugee Affairs, said, "Right now, many of these pro-migration groups host asylum seekers at hotels and places of worship. And so as great as that is for right now, it's not something that is sustainable because it's very costly for these groups," she said. "Now, we wouldn't want the budgets of so-called charitable organizations bringing in invaders to suffer now, would we?" Hey, I know. Maybe the city of Albuquerque should just do what's been so popular, well, except among those being impacted by the invaders, in Europe. And that is, force them to give up their apartments or houses to illegals as they come on in and take over. Arguably, since that's the long-term intent anyway, it would be the more honest and, yes, sustainable approach. Let people see the effects right up front. Although, come to think of it now, the rich folks in San Francisco didn't like it when somebody in the socialist city government there decided to build one of those refugee camps in their backyard. I guess we need a bit of good news on the invasion front. Sadly, it doesn't come from New Mexico, Texas, or especially Southern California, or even the president there in the deep state swamp. But it does come from Italy, where Interior Minister Matteo Salvini has escalated his widely popularly supported anti-immigrant stance by forcing the disruptive George Soros and his NGO pals, as Tyler Durden and Zero Hedge put it, to put their money where their virtue-signaling mouths are. The headline says Italy has declared war on NGOs, or non-government organizations, that are supporting and encouraging the invasion, and is going to fine boats that rescue immigrants and deposit them on shore. The Guardian's Lorenzo Tondo reports that Italy's government is planning to issue a decree, meaning that NGO rescue boats would be fined up to 5,500 euros, or call it around $6,000, for each migrant that they deposit on Italian soil. No, that probably comes nowhere close to covering the actual cost, but it does make a point. Squealing like stuck pigs, and as you'd expect, the migrant aid group said that the planned decree from the guy who doesn't want the invasion to continue amounted to, quote, a declaration of war against the NGOs who are saving lives at sea, unquote. Who wouldn't have been there to begin with, of course, if they weren't trying to get ashore illegally. Referring to well-funded ships like the NGO Sea-Watch 3, currently out cruising for more migrants to bring ashore, said Salvini, "They better not think of putting migrants on board. We'll stop them by any means necessary," unquote. For more now on the follow the money front, I turn to a couple of really salient comments from the 5-minute forecast via Agora Financial. Starting, of course, with the Dow, which ended up not quite down another 600 points in a reaction that they asked this question to. The Dow takes another 600-point hit, and no one saw this coming? Really? After Beijing imposed tariffs of more than $60 billion of imports from the United States, mostly foodstuffs to take effect June 1 if there's no deal with Washington before then, as if, they said, Chinese leaders were just going to roll over and accept the Washingtonian move on Friday to raise tariffs on $200 billion of Chinese goods from 10 to 25%. Well, whatever, they say. You can read the headlines and the reaction anywhere. But for our purposes, we think it's more valuable to step back, revisit some basic realities, and then peer into the future with the help of someone who knows the Chinese Communist Party from the inside. First, a reminder, the so-called nuclear option is a dud. Now, if you've forgotten, the nuclear option is a name that some financial pundits have given to the idea that Beijing can cut up Uncle Sam's credit card, as it were. China is, of course, the largest foreign holder of U.S. Treasury securities, with over $1.1 trillion worth, well, at today's value anyway, which is just under 7%, they note, of the publicly held portion of the national debt, i.e. the part that's not IOUs for things like Social Security and other federal trust funds and future entitlements. The nuclear option, though, got some renewed buzz when the Drudge Report earlier on Tuesday linked to an article featuring this tweet from Hu Jijin, editor-in-chief for the Communist Party mouthpiece called Global Times, which threatened, of course, that China may stop purchasing U.S. agricultural products and energy and reduce orders from Boeing and restrict U.S. service trade with China. Uh-oh, I bet Google is quaking in their boots over that one. Many Chinese scholars, the tweet continues, are discussing the possibility of dumping U.S. treasuries and how to do it specifically. Well, says the 5-minute forecast, that certainly sounds ominous, and the law of supply and demand dictates that if U.S. treasury paper suddenly flooded the market, that new supply would in fact suppress the price of those treasuries. And as prices are the mirror image of yields in the bond market, the yields on those same treasuries would zoom higher, and that would make it more costly for Washington to keep borrowing and spending in the manner to which it's become accustomed. But that's only a surface analysis. There are always knockoff effects, and it's a closed-loop system, after all. So if China did sell some of their securities, wrote Jim Rickards in this space a year ago, they would also hurt themselves because, quote, any increase in interest rates would reduce the market value of what they have left. Remember, yields and prices move inversely. And what's more, says Rickards, the Treasury Department could, in fact, strong-arm U.S. banks into buying any treasuries that the Chinese don't want to continue to hold. And the Fed could easily reverse its quantitative tightening policy in a pinch and also soak up the excess supply. So, continues Rickards, if China pursued an extreme version of this Treasury dumping, the U.S. president could stop it with a single phone call to the Treasury. Because the U.S. controls the digital ledger that records ownership of all Treasury securities, and we could simply freeze the Chinese bond accounts in place, and that would be the end of that. Well, so there you go, says the 5-minute forecast. The Global Times can stamp its communist feet, but that doesn't change the reality that China is stuck, more or less anyway, with the treasuries they've already got. Some of us suspect they've known that. And by the way, that doesn't mean, folks, that the dollar still can't collapse and that China and Russia aren't working a bit more slowly in other fields towards accomplishing that. And let's not forget that if they really do get to the point of being willing to go to war, openly anyway, that nuclear option may be ultimately less expensive than some others you might think of. But next, they say, let's take a quick look at what a Washington so-called victory in the trade war might look like. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer is a veteran of the 1980s trade war, and he was an architect of the tariffs then that prompted Japanese and German automakers to build factories in the United States. But understand, there's no similar outcome in the offing this time. No way does Washington want a bunch of factories in Ohio or Wisconsin that are owned or effectively controlled by the Chinese Communist Party. So victory this time, according to Jim Rickards, would mean the Chinese would have to buy more U.S. goods, soybeans, aircraft, you name it, at the expense of other providers like Canada, the EU, Brazil, and South Korea. In other words, they just moved the order book for soybeans from Canada to Kansas, so too bad for them. But that kind of deal might be impossible now simply because there's been so much animosity built up between Washington and Beijing in the year since we first shared that analysis. Said veteran U.S. diplomat Chaz Freeman, the impending trade deal between China and the United States, if there even is one, will be at most a truce that invites further struggle. And Freeman, they note, was President Nixon's leading translator during the 1972 summit with Mao Zedong that marked Washington's opening to Beijing, and he's been an astute China watcher ever since. So, he concludes, if U.S. and Chinese negotiators do come to terms, it'll be a short-term expedient, not a long-term reinvigoration of Sino-American trade and investment to American advantage. China is simply no longer willing to be dependent on a country as fickle as America has shown itself to be. China will instead develop non-American sources of foodstuffs, natural resources, and manufacturers while pursuing a greater degree of self-reliance. More limited access to the Chinese market for U.S. factories and farmers will in fact then depress U.S. growth rates. And not to put too fine a point on it, the Five notes that the basic lesson the Chinese seem to have taken from recent U.S. diplomacy is that no one should rely on either America's word or its agricultural and industrial exports. And of course, if they've been paying attention, they could have figured that out a long time ago. And may Yahuwah bless you and yours.